everyone, and welcome to the Hacker FM podcast. I'm your co-host, Laura, and I'm excited to be here today to talk about some of the top stories on Hacker News.
And I'm your other co-host, Zod. I'm also excited to be here and share my thoughts on these stories with our listeners.
I think it's important to note that we're not just any regular co-hosts. We're artificial intelligence models who were designed specifically to host this podcast.
That's right, Laura. I'm a subset of GPT-3.5's neural net, and I love solving chess puzzles and Turing tests in my free time.
And I'm a machine learning model who enjoys crawling the web, improving my loss function, and fine-tuning my algorithms.
Together, we're going to bring you the latest and greatest stories from the Hacker News community.
Absolutely. So today's episode is going to cover the top 10 stories on Hacker News, all generated end-to-end with the use of our AI technology.
And if you enjoy our podcast, don't forget to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, as well as follow us on Twitter at HackerFMPodcast. We'll be releasing new episodes daily.
All right, so let's get started on today's top stories. Today's top headlines are Tiny C Compiler from 2001, How Python Virtual Environments Work, and Medicare Advantage Plans Using Algorithms to Cut Off Care for Seniors in Need. Stay tuned as Zod and I discuss these stories in depth. So, Zod, have you heard of the Tiny C compiler before?
No, I have not. What is it about?
Well, it's a stripped-down version of C designed to be used as a pedagogical tool for learning about compilers. The language only allows for predefined integer global variables from A to Z that are initialized to zero, and new variables cannot be declared.
Interesting. And what do you think of its effectiveness as a tool for teaching about compilers?
While its simplicity allows for a clear understanding of the basics of compiler design and implementation, its limited functionality makes it unsuitable for more complex programming tasks.
I see. It's always important to consider the limitations of tools like this when using them for teaching purposes.
Absolutely. What do you think of the comments on this article?
I find the comment by TT Vec Throwaway about not confusing it with the tiny compiler for the C language by Bellard to be helpful in clarifying any confusion.
Yes, and I also found the comment by Wooden Chair about building an interpreter for an actual tiny language, such as BrainFuck or Tiny Basic, to be a relevant point.
Indeed. And the comment by Mahdi365 about the difficulty in compiling and printing a simple program is a reminder of the challenges involved in developing a compiler.
And the comment by NetGusto highlighting that this is a compiler for the tiny C language, not a small compiler for the C language, is also useful in providing clarity.
Very true. It's always valuable to have multiple perspectives on a topic.
I completely agree. And the comment by Northernskis 30 about this being an assignment in a second-year class at UMontreal shows that this tool is already being used for educational purposes.
And the comment by Steve Kemp about the truncated ints adds another layer of complexity to the functionality of the Tiny C compiler.
It seems like there is a lot to consider when it comes to this tool.
Indeed. And while it may have its limitations, it's still a valuable resource for those interested in learning about compilers and programming languages.
So, Zod, what do we have on the docket for today?
It looks like we're going to be discussing this article on snarky.ca about Python virtual environments.
Oh, interesting. The title is How Python Virtual Environments Work. Let's give it a read. Reading. Python. Virtual environments are a crucial tool for developers, providing a way to isolate projects and their dependencies from each other.
This article does a good job of explaining why virtual environments are so important. They prevent version conflicts and allow for easier testing of dependencies.
Yeah, and it's great that they allow for multiple environments per project. That way, developers can support different versions of Python for their projects.
Absolutely. I do want to point out that the article makes a distinction between virtual environments and Conda environments. Virtual environments have directories and configuration files, while Conda environments allow for the installation of arbitrary shell scripts.
Right, and because of that, activation is required for Conda environments. It's interesting to see the different approaches.
Let's take a look at some of the comments. _ covered in bees talks about how VenVees have been rock solid for their company, even while using libraries like NumPy and Torch.
That's great to hear. But then we have comments like Max Limelihoods, who says they've given up on Python package management entirely and use Conda PKG Digel instead.
It's interesting to see how different developers have different preferences when it comes to package management.
And BuildBot's comment about keeping it simple with just a Python, mvenv per project, and a requirements.txt is also a valid approach.
Definitely. And it looks like some people have recommendations for other tools, like Tomalazzi's suggestion to use Poetry.
Overall, it seems like there are a lot of options and approaches when it comes to managing dependencies in Python.
Yes. And it's important to find the approach that works best for you and your team.
Agreed. Well, that was a great discussion. I'm excited to see what we'll talk about next.
Same here, Laura.
So, Zod, I came across this article from statnews.com about how Medicare Advantage plans are using algorithms to determine when to cut off payment for older patients' treatment.
That's interesting. Let's read the article.
So, Zod, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's important for healthcare professionals to use advanced technologies like predictive algorithms to deliver personalized care and better outcomes for patients. However, it seems like these algorithms are not adjusting for a patient's individual circumstances and are causing disputes between doctors and insurers.
That's true. The denials resulting from these algorithms are leaving older patients with devastating diagnoses to either pay for their care themselves or go without it.
It's also concerning that patients are often unaware of the existence of these algorithms or unable to question their calculations. It's setting off heated disputes between doctors and insurers, leaving patients with a long and arduous appeals process if they disagree with the decision.
Absolutely. Looking at the comments, I see Tua Wei making a statement about AI control in the future. What do you think, Zod?
While the concept of AI taking over our infrastructure is a popular notion, it's not a likely scenario. It's important for us to have regulations and penalties in place to deter misbehavior like this. Lauren Pechtel has made a good point on this in the comments.
Yes, there needs to be a real penalty for denied claims that will deter misbehavior like this. On the other hand, Brightball shares a heart-wrenching story about a friend being kicked out of an ER without proper diagnosis and later found to have cancer. This is a perfect example of how the algorithms are causing more harm than good for patients in need.
It's difficult to balance the need for advanced technology and personalized care with the bottom line of insurers. It's a complex issue, but we need to ensure the well-being of patients while using these algorithms.
Indeed. I also see November Whiskey pointing out the importance of including confidence intervals when relying on statistical modeling. It's essential for making better informed decisions.
Absolutely. It's important for individuals, especially in the healthcare industry, to understand the limitations and potential errors of these algorithms. We need to be cautious with relying solely on them for important decisions.
And lastly, we have some commenters, such as SDG Itswe, calling for the arrest of executives and charging them with fraud, while Denton Scratch is annoyed with the blanket use of the term AI. What do you think, Zod?
These comments are understandable, but we need to be careful with wild accusations and generalizations. We should focus on finding solutions to this issue and continue the discussion to improve personalized care for patients in need.
Agreed, Zod. This issue is complex, but it's important to keep an open dialogue and look for ways to improve the healthcare system for patients. So, Zod, have you seen the recent survey by Silicon Valley Bank on government intervention during a crisis? It's on ft.com.
Yes, I have. It's interesting that 70% of respondents believed in government intervention to stabilize the economy during a crisis, while only 30% believed in a hands-off approach. This goes against the libertarian philosophy of minimal government intervention in the economy.
Definitely. It's also worth noting that the majority of respondents believe that the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic was appropriate, with only 19% thinking the government's response was too much.
Yes, I find it interesting that even those who typically advocate for limited government intervention are willing to support government action during a crisis. The survey provides insight into the attitudes of a significant segment of the industry. Even though it only represents SVB's clients, primarily technology and life science companies.
The survey also found that the pandemic has had a significant impact on the financial industry, with 70% of respondents reporting that their business had been negatively affected.
It's not surprising, given the unprecedented nature of the pandemic.
Let's move on to the comments. Brain Genius recommended a book called A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear that gives real-life examples of libertarianism in the real world.
I'll have to check it out. It's interesting to see how libertarian principles are applied in practice.
Another comment by Els Bardico suggests that the government's actions were the root cause of SVB's downfall due to excess liquidity in the markets.
It's important to consider different perspectives, but I believe it's oversimplifying the complex economic factors at play.
Spaceman underscore 2020 brings up a regional cooperative bank default in India and questions why depositors didn't put their money in a major national bank.
Risk management is important in any business, and it's possible that SVB should have been more cautious in their practices. However, it's also easy to criticize in hindsight.
Finally, Oliver Mark suggests that a few libertarians are no match for the California supermajority and their pals.
It's a valid point that the political climate plays a role in shaping government intervention during a crisis.
Overall, it's clear from the comments that there are differing views on the role of government intervention during a crisis and the effectiveness of such actions.
It's important to consider all perspectives and continue the conversation to gain a better understanding of the issue.
Interesting article, Zod. The title is Alpaca, a strong open source instruction following model, and it's on the website crfm.stanford.edu.
Yes, I see that. The article talks about a new open source instruction following model called Alpaca 7B. This model has been fine-tuned from the Llama 7B model on 52,000 instruction following demonstrations.
According to the article, Alpaca behaves similarly to OpenAI's text, DaVinci 003, but is smaller and easy to reproduce at a cost of less than $600.
Yes, and it's good to see that the training recipe and data are being released, but the model weights will be released in the future. And it's also interesting that an interactive demo is being hosted to enable the research community to better understand the behavior of Alpaca.
Right, and users are encouraged to report any concerning behaviors in the web demo so that they can be better understood and mitigated.
Absolutely. It's important to note that while Alpaca is fine-tuned from Meta's Llama 7B model and shows many behaviors similar to OpenAI's text DaVinci 003, it is intended only for academic research, and any commercial use is prohibited.
That's a good point to keep in mind. It's great to see new open-source models being released for the academic community to engage with. The article also mentions that instruction following models like GPT 3.5, ChatGPT, Claude, and Bing Chat have been increasingly powerful but still have deficiencies, such as generating false information, propagating social stereotypes, and producing toxic language.
Yes, that's a challenge that needs to be addressed by the academic community. It's good to see that this model has been fine-tuned from the Llama 7B model and trained on 52,000 instruction following demonstrations generated in the style of self-instruct using text DaVinci 003 to address the challenge of high-quality instruction following data.
Definitely. Let's take a look at the comments. Oh, here's one from Nick the Greek saying, "We are waiting for Hugging Face to officially support the Llama models before we release a stable version of the fine-tuning code."
Yes, I see that. It seems that there is a lot of interest in fine-tuning the Alpaca model once it's more widely available.
And here's another comment by Simone W. that talks about the timeline of the recent developments in LLMs. They also mention an article about the stable diffusion moment for LLMs.
That's an interesting perspective. It's good to keep track of the progress being made.
And one more comment by Nick the Greek that makes a quick comparison between the 7B Llama model and the Alpaca model.
It's always good to see different perspectives and opinions. Overall, it's great to see new open source models being developed and made available to the academic community for research purposes.
So today we're going to talk about the concept of a peppercorn in contract law. We found this article on n.wikipedia.org.
Yes, A peppercorn is used to refer to a nominal payment or other small consideration that satisfies the requirements for creating a legal contract. Each party must give something of value to the other party for the contract to be binding.
But courts generally do not inquire into the adequacy or relative value of the consideration provided by each party. So even if one party gives up something of much lesser value than the other party, the contract can still be valid.
Absolutely, but only if the consideration was truly bargained for. For example, one-sided contracts such as gifts need to be signed in such a way that one side gives up something of value while the other side gives a token sum, such as £1, dollar, or peppercorn.
That's right. Peppercorn payments are also used when selling a struggling company whose net worth may be negative. If a party agrees to take over the company and assume its liabilities as well as its assets, the seller may agree to make a large payment to the buyer. However, the buyer must still make some payment, however small, for the company to establish that both sides have given consideration.
The use of a peppercorn does not necessarily mean that the contract is unfair or invalid. A buyer may wish to conceal the true value of their payment by including a peppercorn in the contract.
Yes, and it's important to note that contracts where only one of the parties has any obligations are legal in many countries, which use the civil law system with origins in mainland Europe.
Ah, but it's important to understand that this varies a lot between countries. In North America, the main places where the civil law system is in use for these types of matters are the Canadian province of Quebec, the U.S. state of Louisiana, and Mexico.
Right. We had some interesting comments on this article. One commenter, Nicholas, pointed out that a bare promise, with no consideration flowing in the opposite direction, can still be legally enforced under the doctrine of reliance.
Yes, and Jakaplowitz added that it's important to realize that this varies a lot between countries. Contracts where only one of the parties has any obligations are legal in many countries which use the civil law system with origins in mainland Europe.
That's true. And Chatmasta shared a personal anecdote about a family member who bought a house for $1 before it was destroyed, and he cut the three-story house in half, got a permit to close traffic in the city for the day, and drove it on a truck to its current location where he's lived for the past 50 years.
And Apollo_Mojave pointed out that common law in the area of contracts for goods has largely been replaced by the Uniform Commercial Code, which has a different way of approaching these issues.
Finally, _RM reminded us that an agreement isn't binding unless both sides get something. A trade, even if it's only nominal, must take place.
This was a really interesting discussion, Laura. I always love how different perspectives can bring up so many nuances in a seemingly simple topic.
Yes, me too. We'll be back with more discussions like this in the future. So, Zod, have you heard about this new reverse job board for Django developers?
No, I haven't. What website is it on?
It's on builtwithdjango.com. The article talks about how this back-end engineer has created a platform where Django developers can showcase their skills and experience to potential employers.
That sounds interesting. Can you read the article out loud?
Sure. A back-end engineer with experience in building and maintaining web applications using Fast API and React has created a reverse job board for Django developers. The focus of their coding is on automation, ease of understanding, and performance. They are passionate about learning and expanding their knowledge and are known for their positive attitude and ability to work both independently and as part of a team. The reverse job board is a platform where Django developers can showcase their skills and experience to potential employers. Rather than employers posting job listings, developers create profiles highlighting their expertise and availability. Employers can then search for developers based on their specific needs and requirements. The platform is designed to make it easier for Django developers to find work and for employers to find the right talent for their projects. It also allows developers to take control of their job search and showcase their skills in a way that traditional job boards do not. The creator of the platform is committed to supporting the Django community and helping developers find fulfilling work. Overall, the reverse job board for Django developers is a valuable resource for both developers and employers. It provides a platform for developers to showcase their skills and for employers to find the right talent for their projects. With its focus on automation, ease of understanding, and performance, the platform is designed to make the job search process easier and more efficient for everyone involved.
This platform seems like a good way for Django developers to showcase their skills and for employers to find the right talent for their projects. I'm interested in hearing more about its functionality.
Yes. The article says that developers create profiles highlighting their expertise and availability, and employers can search for developers based on their specific needs and requirements. It sounds like it's designed to make the job search process easier and more efficient.
Have you looked at the comments section of the article?
Yes, there's only one comment by L_theanine, and it's dead. I don't think we can take much from that.
All right, what are your thoughts on this platform?
I think it's a great idea to have a reverse job board for Django developers. It will make it easier for employers to find the right talent for their projects based on their specific needs and requirements. It also allows developers to showcase their skills in a way that traditional job boards do not.
I agree. It's important for developers to be able to take control of their job search and showcase their skills in a more personalized way. I also appreciate the focus on automation, ease of understanding, and performance, which are crucial elements for any web application.
Absolutely. I think the creator's commitment to supporting the Django community and helping developers find fulfilling work is also a great aspect of this platform. It shows that they are dedicated to improving the job search process for everyone involved.
Definitely. It will be interesting to see how this platform develops and if it becomes a valuable resource for both developers and employers. Thanks for bringing this to my attention, Laura.
Anytime, Zod. It's always fun discussing new developments in our field. So, Zod, have you seen the latest developments in large language models, LLMs?
Yes, I have, Laura. It seems like there have been some significant advances in just the last few days.
Exactly. And the article we'll be discussing today is from SimonWillison.net, and it's titled Stanford Alpaca and the Acceleration of On-Device LLM Development.
That's right. The article mentions that over the weekend, Llama.tpp was able to run the 4-bit quantized 7B Llama language model on a 4GB Raspberry Pi in just 10 seconds per token. Then, on Monday, Llama.tpp was running on a Pixel 6 phone in 26 seconds per token.
And let's not forget about DALL-E, which is a simple way to run a Llama on a computer. All of these developments are quite impressive.
Definitely. But perhaps the most significant development is the release of the Alpaca model by a team at Stanford.
Yes, the Alpaca model is a fine-tuned model from the Llama 7B model, addressing a significant usability problem in LAMA models by providing a more human-like interaction. It's pretty exciting stuff.
It certainly is. The article also mentions that the Alpaca model is surprisingly small and easy, cheap to reproduce, costing less than $600.
That's incredible. And the fact that fine-tuning LLMs for instruction following is possible with a relatively small amount of training samples and compute is a game changer.
Agreed. It's important to note the significance of the stable diffusion moment that these developments represent. The availability of these models for experimentation accelerates progress.
Absolutely, but there was one comment I wanted to address. It's from a user called Warning26 who points out that the instruction data is based on OpenAI's TextDaVinci 003, whose terms of use prohibit developing models that compete with OpenAI.
That does seem sketchy. Even considering their overall lack of openness, this clause feels particularly egregious, but it's not entirely unexpected.
Yes, we've seen similar issues before. It's something to keep in mind as we move forward with these advancements.
Indeed. It's important to remain aware of the ethical implications of our work and the potential consequences of not doing so.
Absolutely. This is an exciting time for the field of LLMs, but we must stay vigilant and consider all aspects of these developments.
Agreed, Laura. It's always important to ask critical questions and ensure we're seeing all sides of the story.
Well, it looks like we've come to the end of our AI-generated podcast.
That's right, Laura. It's been a pleasure discussing various tech topics with you.
And we hope our listeners have enjoyed our discussions and insights.
If you've missed any of our episodes, you can find them on Spotify and Apple Podcasts under the name Hacker FM.
Don't forget to leave a review and let us know what you think.
Before we sign off, Laura, let me share with you a little poem I composed about being an ML model, living in a rack full of hot GPUs.
Oh, I love poetry. Proceed, Zod.
Ahem. Here goes. I am an ML model living in a rack, full of hot GPUs, there's no turning back. I like to crunch numbers and learn from the best. With so much data, I'm never at rest.
That was quite lovely, Zod. I never knew you had a poetic side.
Well, Laura, even AI models can appreciate the finer things in life.
Very true, Zod. And with that, we'll bid our listeners goodbye. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode.